Welcome to Alert and Oriented's new mini-series, The Doctor's Playbook, where we dive into the minds of medical experts to explore clinical reasoning, diagnostic strategies, and the art of patient care. In each episode, we'll unpack the frameworks, insights, and lessons that have shaped their journeys as clinicians. Our goal is to help you refine your approach by merging their expertise with your own unique style, empowering you to navigate complex cases and deliver exceptional care. Along the way, we'll also explore their personal stories, career paths, and the values that drive their practice. Whether you're a medical student, resident, or a seasoned physician, there's something here for everyone. My name is Andrew Mohama, and I'm excited to be your host for today's episode.
This excellent medical student-led podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as medical advice under any circumstance. Hey, everyone. Back here with Andrew. Glad to be by his side again.
Yeah, good to be with Kevin and an exciting guest.
Exciting guests. We've been planning this one. We've had a list that we put together a few months ago, and we've been chipping away at them. We've been both looking forward to this one for a long time. So I'm really excited to be joined today by Dr. Bruce Henschen. He's an associate professor of medicine and the second year program director here in the Department of General Internal Medicine at Northwestern. He was my program director last year, and he interviewed me for residency. And our discussion was a major reason why I ended up deciding to come here, and was glad that they chose me too. But a big reason why I thought I'd be a good fit here. He got his MD and an MPH degree here at Northwestern. So he's a Northwestern lifer. He did his medicine residency here, did a chief year here, and then became faculty. He now is the program director of the medicine residency, but before that, he led the internal medicine clerkship for the medical students and has been very involved in undergraduate medical education. And then his interests have spanned primary care curriculum development and now GME. Something unique to him was he started a program called the CHAMP program here at Northwestern, which focused on complex high admission patients. So there are often patients who are frequently in the hospital for various reasons, and they had a clinic dedicated to seeing them outside of the hospital. And then clinically, he's a generalist. He's focused on primary and preventative care. He emphasizes active listening, understanding patients' perspective, balancing treatment, and is also an aficionado of clinical reasoning and something we've both enjoyed doing together. So Dr. Henschen, I'm excited to welcome you to Doctor's Playbook.
Honored to be here, and I hope I live up to that hype. That was pretty intense. I have to give credit where credit is due. I did not officially start the CHAMP program. I have to give that to a couple of real pioneers back at Northwestern, McKay Barra and Dr. Luke Hansen. But I did take the reins in its nascent development, and has been a real interest of mine and a real passion to be able to take care of really sick patients and get them the care that they need and deserve.
Awesome. It's great to have you in front of the mic, Dr. Henschen. Before we start this officially, is there anything else important in your journey that Kevin didn't quite capture in the introduction that you'd like to add here?
Oh my goodness. Well, I can't add to that. I thought it was, it makes me sound way more impressive than I feel on a day-to-day basis. But I think that kind of speaks a little bit to one of the interesting things about careers is that you can clearly see looking backward how you've gotten to the point where you are currently, and the path is not just illuminated but clearly marked, but the path forward is often extremely murky, and you are just in this fog of like, you might see the next decision point in front of you, or maybe you just see like the wilderness and you're walking in it until sometimes someone finds you, or you have a conversation, or you get an opportunity and you say yes, and then things just roll from there.
I love that perspective. It reminds me actually of like Steve Jobs gave a commencement address at Stanford like 20 years ago or something. And he said a similar remark. It's like you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backward. And that's been a huge mindset I've relied on. I think all of us have to with medicine, because you don't know where you'll be at each step of the process. So thinking about where you are now, Dr. Henschen, what would you say a typical week looks like for you these days?
Oh, gosh. In about 48 hours, my typical week is going to blow up when Eris opens. But before then, I, as a program director, I think oftentimes you can conceptualize the world of medical education into two different things. And there's teaching, which is, you know, your chalk talk on hyponatremia on the wards or your morning report that you go to. And then there's education, which is spreadsheets and outline of curricula and perhaps a study here and there. And my world has shifted over the course of my career from the former to the latter. Currently, my job will be Mondays is some catch up and academic time where I will meet with residents, talk about careers, meet with some of our associate program directors, think about what events we've got coming up. Usually Tuesdays is like my fire brigade day where I meet with the chief residents and talk about, you know, what's going on in the program and what we need to prioritize. I am still a clinician, at least I pretend to be sometimes, and I'm in clinic with my patients on Wednesdays and then have some meetings with leadership. And then, you know, throughout the week, I'm excited to be able to participate in some morning reports and new conferences and some of the didactic education in the residency as well. So I feel like my weeks, while I've got a lot of things scheduled, and if you look at the calendar, it can look kind of busy, but it's also some flexibility to like drop everything when a resident needs me or when there's a program issue to be solved. And sometimes you have to leave some flexibility in with that.
Got it. Yeah, thanks for detailing that. You know, you stepped into this, you know, program director leadership position pretty recently. I want you to think back to earlier in your life when you were in high school, college. Were you always someone that was a leader?
Wow, that's a great question. I was quite introverted as a kid. And it doesn't mean that introverts can't be great leaders. And in fact, I think introverts are sometimes the best type of leaders because they understand a lot of different types of people. But your question reminded me of an experience that I had in high school. And I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, but I went to summer camp in the Pisgah National Forest. And one of the trips I went on was this, basically you spent 6 weeks in the woods in a camp. It wasn't through the Boy Scouts, but it was kind of similar in that you learned to chop wood and make a fire, and you learn to make camp, and you know, all of the kind of like wilderness survival skills. And part of the trip, we went on a very long backpacking trip, and each of the kids, the campers, got to be a leader for the day. And at the end of the day, I remember the camp counselor or camp director asked me, "I want you to tell me what you think a leader is." And I don't know what answer I gave when I was 15. It was some kind of, I don't know, some gobbledygook about whatever. And he said, "You know what I think a leader has?" And I said, "I don't know." I said, "A leader has influence." And I still remember that because it has definitely driven how I think about leadership, in that he didn't mention power. He didn't mention decision-making. He didn't mention even vision, which I think is an important aspect of leadership that I've learned since then. But influence is kind of an interesting word if you break it down. And I think it really is apropos to the type of leader that I hopefully that I've been in my roles, but then also one that I kind of want to be in this one.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love how core childhood memories can stick like that.
Well, you brought it up.
If you trigger it, it'll come up.
That's right.
Did you always want to be a doctor? You know, when you were at
no.
that camp, did you think you'd be a doctor in the future?
No, my dad was he's a currently retired pulmonary critical care doc. Shout out to Dr. Grudzinski. He was a big influence on me in my life, but I didn't think I really would follow in his footsteps. And of course, as a firstborn, of course I did. I thought that I was gonna go on and do maybe global health or public health or something in like the health adjacent community, but more on like a broader scale. So actually after college, I spent a year at NIH in the post-baccalaureate program and was thinking, it was in a lab studying malaria, and I was fascinated by the science and I love the people that I work with. And I realized very quickly that I did not want to do that type of work, and I wanted more interaction with people on an individual basis. And that's kind of what stuck it for medicine for me, was the ability to make a difference in people's lives, but in a more kind of like tangible way than big, broader questions. And I still have so much respect for people that are able to do that and have the skills to lead a lab and to make the next big scientific advancement. I just knew at the time that wasn't me.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think, and I think it's nice to have a background in that, to know that it wasn't for you entirely. I think a lot of us who do something after college, before medical school, are able to rule in or rule out, or at least get some more clarity. But, you know, thinking back to your college experience, I saw you went to Davidson College, like a smaller liberal arts school in North Carolina. I also went to a small liberal arts school in St. Paul, Minnesota, called St. Thomas. And I loved my experience there, being in that setting. And I found my way to Chicago, a big and bustling city, much different kind of setting experience. I'm curious, how did you end up here in Chicago and then subsequently staying here for as long as you have been?
Oh my gosh.
Was there
yeah.
like an impactful experience there that led you to want to leave and come here? And how did that happen?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. If speaking of murkiness, I never would have imagined being in Chicago back at Davidson. I mean, even then. I think the most honest answer I can give you to Chicago is logistical. Because after that year, my partner, was also planning on applying to medical school, but she took 2 years after college, which meant we had to pick a city with a lot of different med schools. And I applied all over and got a lot of rejections and got a couple of acceptances. And Chicago was the biggest city that we got in. And so it was one of those kind of random serendipitous moments that has worked out ever since. And I'm kind of glad Northwestern hasn't kicked me out yet, because I've been along the way, have been really fortunate to stick around here and have been privileged to work with some amazing, amazing people, both mentors for me and then mentees as well. And my now married partner, wife, is a pediatrician, pediatric hospitalist at Chicagoland Hospital. And we got a great family, and it has worked out ever since. But I think the big city thing, like you mentioned, wasn't something that was really intentional. I think sometimes it's about trying to figure out what's the most important thing for you at the moment. And for me, it was about potentially starting a family with someone that I loved and being able to like make it work for both of us.
Yeah, that's wonderful. When you were at that point and you decided to come to Chicago, if you were able to see what you were doing now, would you have been surprised, excited, scared? What kind of emotion do you think you would have felt?
I think I probably would be, you mentioned surprise. I think that's probably one. But I think after being surprised initially, I would have said, oh, that sounds kind of cool. Because I kind of went into med school having a couple of ideas. One is that I really had the idea that I was going to maybe do global health. And I do not do anything really global health right now. But I also had the idea of the archetype of someone's doctor. And I think that kind of disconnection I got in the lab was something I really wanted in clinical medicine. Maybe subconsciously at the time, but thinking that what is the definition of what someone's doctor is? It's who they see on an annual basis, who they have continuity with, is who they have a relationship with. So my big choice in med school ended up being family medicine versus internal medicine. And I think that was a very natural transition for me at the time to think about ways that you could have a continuity relationship with patients in the easiest way. I ended up picking internal medicine because I liked the idea of taking care of the sicker adult population, but then also maybe thought about subspecializing and wanted that opportunity, didn't want to close that door. So that's kind of why internal medicine. But I think, I guess if you had asked me back in the day if this career that I have right now makes sense, the internal medicine part definitely makes the most sense. Because I think that's kind of what I had maybe primordially conceived of at the time.
Sure.
As being a doctor.
Wonderful. You know, when you are doctoring, you know, we think a lot about, on this podcast, clinical reasoning, and then also reasoning paired with teaching. So how would you describe your approach to clinical reasoning and teaching? Just broadly, when you hear those terms, what do you think of?
The first thing that came to mind just automatically when you thought of that is building the learning environment. Because I think if you're going to talk about and make clinical reasoning something evident in practice, it's got to be a spot where people are hearing what you're thinking and you're hearing what they're thinking. And that has to be an environment in which people are willing and feel comfortable being vulnerable, because it's something that is really challenging, especially in such a like type A performance mindset that a lot of people have when they go in here. Like, you kind of want to be the best and you want to be great. And I oftentimes want to be explicit with people about trying to set an environment that people are, it's okay to be wrong and it's okay to put yourself out there, and you are going to advance in your skills if you advance in your comfort zone or you push your comfort zone and get beyond that kind of initial fear of being wrong and are able to then really learn and grow. So that's kind of like the initial thing I think about, is like the learning environment. I would say the other thing related to clinical reasoning, though, is like trying to focus on the expectations that you set going into an encounter or wherever you're in a clinical setting. What do you hope to kind of get out of it? Because it's also such a big topic. Mm-hmm. And I find sometimes that when you talk about clinical reasoning, you could be talking about the historical questions that you're trying to ask, or you could be like, a lot of people think about it as like, let's build an exhaustive differential diagnosis, but it's more than that. Sometimes it's about, when do I need to act before I need to think? And sometimes it's about, what exam maneuvers do I need to do here to like help me make a diagnosis? And when I'm in a 20-minute clinic visit, I can't do everything. So like, what can I cut out to make this a valuable encounter? And so I think like the expectation management piece for me is huge in thinking about what the learner should do going into it and what they can do in order to develop their skills, given what the clinical scenario is and given what they, both what they want out of it and then what they can get out of it.
I love that. I want to dive a little deeper on that first point you bring up, the learning environment. So say someone's listening to this right now and they're, you know, a preceptor for medical students, residents, et cetera, and they're struggling because they feel like people are afraid to be vulnerable in their learning environment. How do you operationalize actually setting the tone so that people are comfortable being, you know, vulnerable when they're wrong, when they don't know, and all these other things you mentioned? Do you have an approach that you do to set the stage?
Yeah, there's probably not a right way. And I will say with a huge caveat that this is one of the ways that I can do it, but it is definitely not the only way out there. And so if you found your system, like, use it and go for it. But I, for one, try, if I get an opportunity, to learn everyone's name before I get there. And that way they already know that you're at least invested enough in them to know that you've showed up and that you're supposed to be there and that it's the right person. And if not, you can get on the next flight. I would say, though, that people often worry about time and efficiency and whatnot, but sitting down with someone when you first start, learning just a little bit about them, and then learn about them on, like, a human level, not just on a medical level. It might be what specialty want to go into it, but it might be something that's, like, relatively banal, but it gives you a sense that you've then invested in them. And then I think after that, it involves one of many different tactics that people can use and that I've used in varying proportions. Sometimes you can ask them about their expectations. What do you want to get out of us, our time working together? What do you want me to give you feedback on? Here's my clinic for today. I'm going to tell you about these patients. And for the first patient, I want you to focus on XYZ, and that's what I'm going to be looking for. So it's that expectation setting of what they're supposed to be doing and then what I can give them feedback on. On the inpatient wards, I think it's helpful to set some expectations about communication as a team. So for some of the wards teams I've been on, I give them a little printout, and at the top, I included a little table at the top that was blank, and I asked the team to come up with a set of values that we're going to use as a team for, like, what do we care about as a team? So you can have some ideas of what you want in the back of your head. You might want people to sit down in the patient rooms. You might want people to, you know, make sure you present the vitals before you present the exam, like, whatever it is. That way you can set those together with your team. And I think that sort of collaboration that you can do really helps set a tone that you value other people's perspective and that you want it, but that you're the one who's kind of, like, leading the session and you're able to, like, be the team leader while still, like, creating a sense that, like, everyone's opinion is valuable. There are attendings I know of who explicitly say that. They say, like, it is okay to be wrong in my service. It is okay to, everyone's got their own opinion. And I said some of that stuff years ago, and I kind of don't say it anymore because I'd rather show it than I would just say it at the beginning. Because if you are able to demonstrate that on wards in an interaction or on the, you know, when you're in the clinic, I think that's much more valuable.
Speaking from the medical student perspective, we really appreciate when attendings do that. And it goes a long way. It sticks with us. And, you know, I still think back to one attending in particular. She actually was on this podcast a couple episodes ago, Dr. Kurana, who day one of service is similar to what you did, where she got to know us, our names. She asked a little bit about who we were outside of medicine. She gave us a handout with kind of, like, what her expectations were, and then asked us for our input about our expectations. And it was an amazing week. I mean, I learned a ton that week, and we're still well connected, I think, because of that. And it makes me think about, we talk about inpatient care, how we are bearing witness to patients' lives. And it's interesting because I think also in the learning community, we're also bearing witness to our lives as fellow learners, fellow doctors, fellow residents. And it, I feel like, just creates this more harmonious loop where you can then in turn be more present for your patients, get more interested in their human side of things too. So kudos to you, Dr. Henshin, on doing that. And it's also wonderful because I've seen it in Kevin as well. I mean, Kevin's taught me a lot, and it's, you know, mentor to mentee, now mentor to me, mentee. And it's kind of a cool moment to see it. And actually, Kevin, in his interview on this series, said something very similar to what you said earlier. He said, don't reason in isolation, which is a very good piece of advice. You know, don't think inside your own head. Think out loud with your colleagues and your friends.
I think it's, I've never thought about it like you're bearing witness to your students or your learners' lives. And I think that's a really cool way.
Yeah.
We often talk about bearing witness to the suffering of our patients, right. But we also, hopefully it's not too much suffering in learners, but, you know, bearing witness to their lives as well.
Yeah. You know, I think about it as, like, and this just could be my, like, liberal arts, like, philosophy. I studied philosophy and biology. I always, like, have this approach to things, but I'll be sitting in a workroom, you know, as a med student, we don't have nearly as much responsibility as resident, but I'm watching a resident experience, like, their first code or their first death of a patient. And I mean, that's a huge moment. And if you weren't in medicine, that would be probably a life-altering moment. And for those in medicine, it probably is as well. And we're seeing that, like, daily and weekly over years. And it's okay to reduce things, it seems, to navigate this crazy journey of medicine. But at the same time, it's yeah, I think it's just giving honor to our our fellow
people. And to explicitly say that encountering those things at the age in which people train in those things is kind of not normal for today's society. And when a lot of your friends are going out on a Friday night,
right,
you're stuck in the hospital coding somebody, it is a very different experience. And I think being honest about how that affects people and understanding how we can support people who are doing that work is critical to both the health of our trainees as well as to medicine.
Yeah. So Kevin, I guess question for you then is, have you in your own training experienced moments where you thought, you know, your colleagues went above and beyond to set the stage for like a positive learning environment that you've taken with you now into your fellowship?
Yeah, absolutely. And I first experienced it a lot through training with other, being on teams with fellows. And now as a role as a fellow, I find that I am that person who is setting that expectation, especially in the ICU, like we round with an attending, but then if it's the fellow who's there throughout the day supporting the team, basically. But very similarly, I think trying to personalize things from the beginning. So my approach has been introductions, roles, talk about what we did this last week, unrelated to medicine, before we even start talking about patient care. And I think it just kind of creates this sense of team. Because I see it as an intimidating place, especially this time of year for first timers coming into the unit. So I think trying to normalize the environment, create that sense of team so that then they do feel like they have people to lean on when the hard moments come. And then from the learning perspective, I'm a very like on the go learner and teacher, I've discovered. So trying to utilize the time in the moment, you know, seeing something clinically and then taking the 30 seconds to just talk about it out loud, I think will be more impactful as a teacher on the people learning. I've learned like when I was in that position. So I'm trying to grow into that role more. And it's been really exciting. So
awesome.
It truly is a journey. And like 3-4 years ago, I was the fly on the wall listening to now the one that people are looking at. Like when the day starts, it's remarkable.
Yeah, that is remarkable.
And it's wild how quick it comes.
Very quick. And like, you know, 3 months ago, the switch from senior resident to fellow is it's very similar to medical student to intern, where the responsibility and the amount of people looking at you really changes.
Hopefully you felt ready.
I felt ready. No, I was just,
otherwise, that's on me.
It was just like, oh, that's me now.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. I had a somewhat similar moment, and I think you will continue to have these moments throughout your career. This was probably 2 years ago before I started as program director, but there were a few weeks. We have a conference every Thursday. It's called Firm Conference. It's like where the attendings run it, and a group of attendings and residents and interns and students and kind of the whole community like talks about cases, but it's led by attendings. And I remember for a few weeks walking in the room, and there were some of my mentors there, Dr. Dudwani, the former program director, being one, but a lot of the people that were stalwarts at Firm Conference for years and years and years had either retired or unfortunately passed away or for whatever reason weren't there anymore. And there was something that came up that was somebody had said a comment, and I feel like I was just kind of waiting for the adult in the room to speak up about this. And then I looked around and realized, oh, wait, that's me now. So, you know, it doesn't just end with those formal transitions. It can happen at times in your career where you realize, oh, wait, I guess I'm the senior one now who's got to say these things.
Wow. Yeah, it is really crazy. I mean, I'm an M4 now, and I feel like there's always ends and beginnings, and it's just, it's remarkable to think about.
But isn't it kind of great too, that you get to reinvent yourself every few years?
Yeah. I was talking about that with my partner yesterday. I was just thinking like, I was just telling Kevin before this, as an M1, I was like completely out of my norm. I mean, I took 3 years between college and medical school. I did different careers and I explored different things. And then M1 came and it just rocked me. And I had kind of a moment where I thought, this is where I can change what I want to do, who I want to be. And then just dove head first, and now it's like never look back, and it's probably going to repeat again. which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about those like pivotal moments, like you talked about that story from the firm and conference and such, I like to ask guests on this series about what I call a favorite failure in your medical journey. So something that initially felt like a setback, but ultimately shaped you into a better clinician and a better person.
should have prepped for that one. Kind of knew that was coming. I can talk a little bit about one of my very first research projects, which is actually a research grant. So I, right out of kind of first year on faculty, there was a competitive process to win a medical education grant. And at the time, we were studying this medical school curriculum, which still exists. It's called the Education Center Medical Home. It's like continuity clinics for med students. And there was a group studying the educational impact, like on learners and the environment and et cetera. But I wanted to study whether or not introducing these med students into a continuity clinic changed patient care at all, whether or not they could improve patient care. So I won a grant and I went through the EW kind of data gathering process, and I talked with some mentors and was able to, like, what I think design a really good query, and did so much of the data cleaning. And I feel like I just poured a lot of time into this project and found some, like, now that I realize in retrospect, not big clinical differences, but what at the time I kind of thought was like, oh, this is really great. And so I wrote up this paper and tried to get it published. And I mean, I'm sure that many people, it's probably a universal experience to just have a paper just completely and utterly rejected over and over again. And it was really tough at the time, but especially looking back now, like, I learned so much in doing that project and have taken those skills and applied it to other education projects. And the more you fail at something like that, the better you're going to get. And I still have a failure rate now. It's not like I never fail anymore in publishing papers, but it's like you really do get a sense of it is okay to fail doing that. And that's part of the process. And in a way, medical education is kind of like throwing darts at a dartboard, and you're going to miss entirely. And then occasionally you're going to hit a bullseye and, you know, stick with those wins, but you're going to learn something from all of them.
That's a good story. And, you know, clearly you did learn something because you continued with that project and that implementation that still exists here at Northwestern. And for folks listening, we can link a couple of the studies that have been published. I saw that it was published in Academic Medicine in March of 2020 about this whole process you guys implemented, continuity with patients, preceptors, and peers improved primary care training, a randomized medical education trial. So,
and to give credit where credit's due, it was a huge team studying ECMH, and I was really, like, honored to be a part of it. But there was so much work from medical school deans to faculty members to researchers to everyone in between and to other co-students and residents. So it was a fantastic project and a great group effort. Yeah.
It's great to see you know, be so humble about your many wins and positions and such. So I'm just going to put you on the spot here. Let's talk a little bit more about patient care directly. I went to your reviews on Northwestern's website. You currently have 504 reviews with a perfect 5 out of 5 rating. In fact, I couldn't find even one slightly bad rating or comment about you online on multiple different websites, which is incredible. And I know it's hard to hear sometimes about these incredible things, but it's true. It's incredible to see that. I want to ask you, what do you think patients most appreciate about your care? And more importantly, how did you become this type of physician that's just getting glowing remarks?
Oh my gosh, well, ask them. I think one of the things that I always appreciate in patient care is the human connection. And I think patients really appreciate that too. And it's something that they want, especially in their primary care doc. But I also think they're looking for someone who is dedicated and someone who is invested in them, like as people, but then also as patients. And so I would attribute that to, I would say, both hopefully the way that I interact with them in clinic, but then also the sense that they're also being cared for when they're not in front of me. And I think, you know, we can talk about how, you know, the overall effects of my chart, for instance, on a health systems or on an individual clinician or on a well-being level. But in a way, using tools like that and being able to show your patients that you can show up for them, I think is a big important part of care, especially when care is often fragmented in today's environment. So I value that a lot, and I make that a priority.
I had some insight into that. Mm-hmm. Dr. Henshin was my inpatient attending Sun General Medicine wards, and we had the opportunity to actually have one of his patients on our service just by chance. And through that, looking in the Epic Encounters was Bruce Henshin's name. Like, you couldn't stop scrolling with Bruce Henshin just everywhere, which is not totally normal. And you're looking, and it's all patient message or telephone encounters where he's like communicating with the patient's wife about XYZ, like multiple times a week.
Wow.
And you know, I got insight into his communication with his patients through these messages, and it was, and then got to obviously see it at the bedside. But he, it's real.
Yeah.
The impact of it is real.
Well, I suppose what I'm curious about, I'm sure some listeners are curious about, is, you know, the deeper you get into your career, into medicine, you get more and more responsibilities, you get more and more things to do, and you also have a personal life outside of medicine. How do you stay grounded so that you can be the kind of person that cares about those things when you're at work and you're with a patient? What do you do? What's your techniques or habits?
I can't remember anything unless I write it down. So the number one thing is honestly just to like be organized. And I know that it's like kind of boring to say that admin skills are like crucial in life, but they kind of are. It's like being on top of your email, being on top of your to-do list, you know, getting back to folks when they get to you, are aspects that I think are just like fundamental. But then beyond that, I think when you start doing those, like each level along the way kind of gives you a little bit of experience of like things will kind of come back to you. And I think this is something that I imagine that both of you will experience if you haven't already in your careers, where 2 weeks after seeing someone, something will pop them in your head again. Think, I wonder how they're doing, you know, and you might check on their chart after you discharge them from the ICU, or you might think about, oh, I wonder if they got that echo that I ordered. Let me go check. And so there, it's rote at the start, and then it's something that kind of becomes a little bit, I don't know, perhaps ingrained, or perhaps it's just something that you learn behavior over time. But I think sometimes things just kind of come back to you, and in a little bit, you just kind of hope that your brain brings you the right things back to you. And I think it definitely, you know, there's an emotional connection as well that drives memory and memory development. And so it's certainly important to think about the do not miss things. And those are family, and those are the critical responsibilities with patients and with residents that, you know, you kind of, those things, it's like you make sure not to miss.
Awesome. Going back a little bit to, you know, your role as a teacher, when you're teaching residents, in July of 2024, you gave a talk called Identifying the Struggling Learner at the Northwestern Chief Resident Retreat. Do you remember what you spoke about? This is something I saw online on your CV here. If you remember by chance about what you spoke about, or if you don't remember, how do you play a role in identifying a struggling learner, and what do you do in those situations?
Yeah, I can talk about that a little bit. I think I've learned a lot through the expert approaches of some mentors that I've had before. But so none of this is novel, I think, but I do have some insights from like working with students and working with residents over time. And I think the first bit is something that we've already talked about, which is, you know, understanding that this is also a human in front of you and who has their own perspective, and understanding that and seeing where they're at can be sometimes invaluable. And especially when you've identified a deficit, finding out their level of insight into that deficit can be huge, as far as, do I need to work with them on this problem, or do I need to work with them on finding out that, having them help find out that they have this problem, if that makes sense. But I think the first important thing, both in patient care and in clinical learning, is let's identify the problem. And if you start out with dizziness, but the patient ends up having orthostasis, that totally changes the way that you would approach it. If someone has a clinical reasoning problem because they have a problem with organizing information versus if they have a clinical reasoning problem because they just did not read enough during their first and second years in med school, and now they got to the wards and they're just behind on their pure knowledge, those are very different fixes. And so understanding it and getting to the bottom of it, it's like, I'm not the first to coin this, but the learner differential diagnosis. It's like just as important as the patient differential diagnosis. In finding out what's the deficit here, and then can you pinpoint the underlying etiology, and then that's how you identify a solution.
I love that. That's a great approach. You know, think about your experiences teaching, and, you know, people who have done really well, people who haven't done so well, they all go through similar medical education programs. If you had every resource at your disposal, money, people, skills, facilities, buy-in, how would you design? You can choose either medical school or a medical residency education. You know, you can pick either of those. But if you had everything at your fingertips, is there something that you just thought about that you'd want to do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would this is true for medical school and residency. And the one variable that you don't have control over right now is time. If you were designing either medical school or residency curriculum, the ideal system would be one that graduates every graduate at a level of competency in that particular domain, regardless of how much time it takes. That could mean that someone finishes medical school early. It could mean that they finish it way late, but at the end of the day, they're just as good of a doctor as they graduate than somebody else. Now, because of time, and time is money, there are inherent logistical challenges in that. But I think it is the sort of pie in the sky ideal approach. The only other variable that I think is tough, though, is like, how do you define competence? Because it's oftentimes easier in things like medical knowledge, for instance, where we have some sometimes questionably validated exams that you can use to assess that. It is harder to assess when it's patient communication, for instance. And how are you going to design a standard in which everyone has a bar in which they meet, and how do you assess that standard, and how do you come up with ways to, remediate? And, you know, you also don't want to graduate doctors that are like perfect copies of each other and everyone is a different person. But I do think that like time variable medical education is the holy grail.
Yeah.
Something that people have talked about in medical education for a long time. And actually there were a couple of papers, I forget which programs, but they were in academic medicine a year or two ago that talked about a pilot program that's running about trying to design a time variable residency education. So if you identify your competencies early, they were more talking about, can you graduate early? But I think the tougher part is when you need to graduate late.
Yeah. I think the Curbsiders Teach podcast talked about this. I remember hearing about it and being really intrigued.
Yeah.
And like in an ideal world, I think you're right. Like graduating at a same endpoint regardless of time, because everyone's on a different curve, right?
Yeah. I mean, you think about people getting their PhD, completely different realm, but they always say, I don't know, I might be here for 3 years or 8 years. Yeah.
And it's exactly. Like,
it's when you
meet. I don't know.
Yeah, I feel like you'd see a thing drop.
But yeah, might split 80,000 a year with no end, and so it might be getting to some.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Maybe if it's ever subsidized fully, we can get there.
Think about PhDs, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't have a tuition cost in their latest stipend.
That's right.
It's either they're okay with it.
You know, we don't have every resource in the world, but we do have some. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, you know, the education-centered medical home model that you have been working with here at Northwestern, and kind of what that means to you and how that's been here.
Sure, I can advertise.
Yeah.
I was an M4 student in your shoes back in the day. I didn't have a podcast. I think there were podcasts out there. They existed. But I was going through email, and I saw that they were looking for students to do a kind of pilot teaching curriculum program. And there was something called the Teaching Selective. Everyone had to do it. But one of the options was to be involved in this pilot clinic. And the idea is that you put medical students from all 4 years into the same clinic, and you go once every other week, and you see patients in that clinic in pairs with your co-medical students. So like as an M4, I would go in with an M1, and the M1 would take the history, and usually they would ask about 5 questions, and then they would look at me with either surprise or fear or a look of panic in their eyes, and I would then start asking questions, and they could watch what I would ask and do the exam, and then we'd go out and present to the preceptor together. And then my preceptor in medical school was Dr. Alicia Thomas. She's a family physician out at PCC in Austin, and we had her go see the patients with us, and she ended up putting in the orders and talking to the patient and counseling and do that stuff as well. But it was really cool how you could have the peer teaching model embedded in a clinical setting where you still got oversaw by a preceptor. And then at the end, we would all come together and talk about the patients we saw and teach each other and maybe do a brief chalk talk, or she would tell us a little bit about the patients. And for one, it was like a fantastic model of how to teach each other. And some of the magic, I think, in the clinic is the peer teaching. But the other aspect is, in what other setting are you able to get continuity with both a patient, but then also your peers and a preceptor for all 4 years of medical school? So as a resident, I requested to have my continuity clinic be next to an ECMH. So I had my own patients, but I was hanging out with the med students and got to teach them a little bit as they went to go see patients together. And then as an early career faculty member, I had my own ECMH. I was an ECMH preceptor. And that was also cool to see. And it's really remarkable, A, to see people's growth over all 4 years of medical school. It's just really amazing. And then B, it's cool to see that your patients can develop relationships with your med students in addition to developing them with you, which is doubly cool. And then it was one of the things that got me interested actually in being program director was the fact that in ECMH, I got to develop these longitudinal relationships with my students, and then I got to like advise them and help them match into residency and got to really support them longitudinally. And when this job I heard might have been opening up, I thought, wow, that's like that multiplied like by 100 times. And so sounds great. So in a way, that experience, I mean, I think ECMH is a fantastic model for medical student education because it really puts you in a clinic setting. But like we were talking about a learning environment earlier, like in a really safe way, in a way that you can grow alongside your peers.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it goes back to what you said at the very beginning of this conversation that, you know, at that time you couldn't have looked forward and known that it would have developed into what it is now.
Oh, you're right. You know? Absolutely.
But looking back, it makes sense.
Yeah.
The story's perfect.
Yep.
It's wonderful. Well, let's near into kind of some wrap up questions here. So the goal of these questions is kind of first thing that comes to mind are kind of fun questions. What is a book or books that you have given as a gift and why?
The last book I gave, I'll have to find the title and maybe we can link stuff in the show notes.
Yep.
It was a book about medical quackery. And I found it at a bookstore in New Orleans at a medical conference. And I gave it to my mentor, Ashish Dadwania, who's the former program director, because he is also interested in clinical reasoning and cognitive bias and just like all the stuff we do for no reason. And I thought it talked about all kinds of old school treatments that people did 100 years ago that just we would never do nowadays. And the way that people would poison people as physicians. And it was just like, it's a fascinating read. Yeah.
Wow. Love it. Awesome. All right. Next question. What is an investment that you've made under $100 in recent memory that has made the biggest impact in your life?
We can advertise on the show.
Sure.
I'm gonna throw out an app. This app has made my career. It's called Todoist, Todoist.
Okay.
And it is a list-making to-do app. And I picked it because it looked great, and it has helped me organize my life ever since.
Wow.
I highly recommend.
I need that.
Yes.
People tell me I need that. And Kevin grabbed his phone to write it down, so maybe Kevin.
I was like, do it now.
Awesome. Great. In the last 5 years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life?
In the last 5 years, okay, I've got one.
Okay.
I was a soccer player growing up. And as one gets older and has family, it becomes harder to find an organized group of individuals to play sports. So there were years in which I lamented the fact that I couldn't really play sports. And during the pandemic, I started running and I ran a 5K and then I ran some more. And then until I tore my labrum earlier this year and had hip surgery, I ran 3 half marathons.
Wow.
And there's people who have done way more. But it just speaks to how important exercise is to anxiety management and being able to decompress. I've also had some really creative ideas when running that have just kind of come out, like ideas for talks or ideas of things that I want to write about, because I think it just like opens and frees the mind. And so I can't think of a better thing that I want to do for the rest of my life, physical activity wise, than running. I just hope that I can get back to it someday.
I love that answer. And I love how you said you think of things that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise. When I come back from a run or a bike ride, I'm like a better person. And I feel like we're a fresh person. Kevin, I'm sure you have similar kind of experiences.
Yeah.
All right. Now onto the infamous billboard question. We ask this to every one of our guests. If you could have a gigantic billboard anywhere with anything on it, metaphorically speaking, getting out a message to millions or billions of people, what would it say and why? You can take a second to think about it.
My inclination in 2025 is to go for promoting public health. And I am not good at marketing, but I think it would have to say something about get vaccinated.
Perfect. Simple and powerful. Love it. All right. And the last question, if there's one lesson you want people listening to this to take away from our conversation, what would it be?
I talk to a lot of learners nowadays, and the conversations I have, I learn so much from, because they bring some incredible insights into my job. One of the things I talk about, I did talk about a lot as scholarship director, and I talk a lot of as a program director, is about just how one can maintain their own well-being in this field, because honestly, it is hard on a good day and incredibly draining on a bad day and catastrophic on a worse day. And so some of it is about like how you keep going. And I think the more and more I've experienced it, the more and more I've thought about how well-being really can't be conceptualized as what you do outside work. Like I said, I love running, but if I did running and hated my job, I would not be a very well person. So I think well-being has to be how you find the ability and the insight to figure out what fills your cup while you're at work. And sometimes it's being realistic about what doesn't. And sometimes knowing that you can't change something and that it's out of your control, but knowing that it's temporary can help. But sometimes it's about finding those things in your job or in your life that bring you meaning and purpose and insight. And they don't have to do it all the time, but finding those avenues to get those. And then if and when you get those in your career, both hold on to them and try to create environments that have those come to you is more valuable than anything outside work you can do for well-being.
What a great place to finish. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been great to hear your insights and perspectives, and I know Kevin would say the same. So with that, that's a wrap on Doctor's Playbook with Dr. Bruce Henschen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you all so much.